It's the NPR News Update for Thursday, July 30. I'm Phil Picardi with the Minnesota News in-depth and in podcast form. It is changing next week. We'll have a new podcast with NPR stories called The Ticker. You can subscribe at nprnews.org/podcasts or find it on iTunes. Today on the podcast, student test scores, claims against the Archdiocese, and lions, fish, and kitties. Oh my. The latest round of statewide reading, math, and science test results are out today, and they show little change in scores for Minnesota students compared to last year. Reading proficiency inched up only slightly, math scores overall were down, and the persistent gap in scores between students of color and white students remains. State education officials say widely reported problems in online testing this spring had actually no effect on overall scores. Tim Post has the story.
The test scores come from the Minnesota Comprehensive Assessments most students take each spring. The exams measure proficiency in reading, math, and science. This year, 59% of students overall tested proficient in reading, the same as last year, and only one percentage point higher than 2 years ago. Meanwhile, math proficiency among all students fell one percentage point to 62%. Those aren't the results State Education Commissioner Brenda Caselius had hoped for.
No, I'm never satisfied unless we see forward progress in math, science, reading.
Of particular concern to Caselius is the gap in scores between white students and students of color. Overall, 70% of white students in 3rd through 8th grade were proficient in math. 33% of black students met math proficiency goals. That 37 percentage point gap has grown slightly in each of the last 2 years. Results in reading scores tell a similar story. Caselius says the data show the state needs to continue to offer professional development for teachers in struggling schools as a way to boost test scores for students of color.
We want to see all kids go up, but we want to see the kids who have been historically underachieving, their scores go up even faster. I mean, that's how you'll get the gap closure.
The state's two largest urban districts saw mixed results similar to the state's. Michelle Walker is chief executive officer for the St. Paul School District.
We stayed the same in our reading proficiency. We saw a slight decrease in our math proficiency, and we saw a slight increase in our science proficiency.
Walker says the district is beginning to close the achievement gap in some grade levels and at certain schools, but overall, she says, that's not happening fast enough. Much like St. Paul, the Minneapolis district saw reading and math scores remain stable overall, with an increase in science scores. Interim Superintendent Michael Gore says there were bigger increases at a few of the district's struggling schools. For example, Jenny Lind Elementary saw a nearly 6 percentage point increase in reading scores. Even with that increase, only 21% of the school's students now test proficient in reading. But Gore is confident more increases are on the way for Jenny Lind and the entire district.
We're optimistic that what we're working on now is, in fact, making some significant difference.
Gore thinks a new district effort to give some Minneapolis schools more freedom to make budget, curriculum, and scheduling decisions will lead to better test scores in coming years. Hanging over this year's MCA scores was the question of whether the scores were valid at all. Computer glitches caused delays for thousands of students during spring testing. The Department of Education halted testing on two separate days. Education Commissioner Caselius says a third-party investigation found those problems did not invalidate the test scores.
There was no statistical evidence to support that on average there were any impacts to statewide scores.
But the head of the statewide teachers union Education Minnesota isn't convinced. Denise Specht says a union survey of 500 teachers this spring showed they have little confidence in this year's scores.
If I were a parent or a teacher, principal, or superintendent, I would be skeptical about the results.
Despite findings in the independent report that this year's scores are valid, testing vendor Pearson may owe the state damages because of the testing glitches. The Department of Education is negotiating with Pearson now over that issue and is expected to offer an update within a week or two. Tim Post, Minnesota Public Radio News.
Time is running out for sex abuse victims and other parties to file claims against the bankrupt Archdiocese of St. Paul and Minneapolis. But that could change. A federal judge is hearing arguments today for and against extending the claims deadline past next Monday, pushing the cutoff date back to May of next year. Reporter Martin Moylan has more.
The creditors' committee in the case, composed entirely of sex abuse victims, contends the archdiocese has provided inadequate notice of the August 3rd deadline and wants to give victims more time to file. The committee also contends that pushing back the deadline would actually expedite a settlement and provide more insurance money for abuse victims. Robert Kugler is the attorney for the creditors' committee. He says insurers don't want to settle claims against the archdiocese, only to get hit with another round of potentially costly claims against the parishes for abuse suffered perhaps decades ago.
They want final resolution on both the archdiocese and the parishes, and so they will not be able to settle or in a position to settle until May 25, 2016, when all the known claims come forward against the parishes.
The state legislature set that May deadline as part of the Minnesota Child Victims Act, which temporarily lifted legal limits on filing older abuse claims. In the Archdiocese bankruptcy, though, Judge Robert Kressel set an August 3rd cutoff for the, quote, timely filing of claims. For insurers, Kugler says a shorter deadline
limits the amount of money that they would be willing to contribute to a resolution, which in turn means that other sources are going to have to be looked to, and that leaves the archdiocese and the parishes.
NPR News asked attorneys for seven archdiocese insurers what they thought of that argument. None would comment. Victims attorney Jeff Anderson favors a deadline extension, both to give abuse survivors more time to come forward and to hopefully extract more money out of insurers.
There is a lot of insurance, and there are a lot of insurance companies, but to have them fully engage and adhere to their responsibilities, it really would help to have the deadline extended.
The Archdiocese reports it has about $29 million in net assets, but not all of that would be available to compensate creditors. The church hopes that insurers will provide substantial sums of money to compensate abuse victims, but insurers could deny claims, arguing, among other things, that the Archdiocese forfeited coverage by ignoring and covering up clergy sex abuse. The archdiocese and parishes oppose extension of the window for filing claims. Attorney Mary Jo Jensen Carter represents about 120 parishes.
I don't think, to the best of my knowledge, that there's any insurers out there that are raising any issues related to this bar date of August 3rd being a problem.
Jensen Carter says she expects the eventual archdiocese bankruptcy reorganization plan could address potential abuse claims and lawsuits against parishes.
To the extent that the parishes become embroiled in any of these clergy abuse claims, we're asking that the archdiocese be required to indemnify the parishes for any damages they suffer as a result of those claims.
In a court filing, archdiocese attorneys argued it is unlikely the parishes will face a flurry of abuse lawsuits, and they also warned that the legislature could again extend the window for filing claims for sex abuse suffered long ago. Knowing the universe of claims against it is essential for the archdiocese to develop a reorganization plan. That'll include setting aside some money to compensate abuse victims and developing a process for determining payments. Christopher Soper is a law professor at the University of Minnesota.
If it goes the way of most of these other church bankruptcies, the pot of money will be administered by a trustee, and there's procedures that are set out in advance for how much certain claims are worth without having to go through and litigate each claim.
As of late Wednesday, more than 400 creditors had filed claims. Abuse victims accounted for more than 250 of them. Martin Moylan, Minnesota Public Radio News.
A Twin Cities dentist is facing a fierce backlash for killing a popular lion earlier this year in southern Africa. Protesters demonstrated outside Dr. Walter Palmer's office in Bloomington yesterday, and the online criticism reached a fever pitch. But as Matt Sepik reports, all the vitriol may not necessarily mean the end of Palmer's dental practice.
The anger has been incessant since the news broke that dentist Walter Palmer allegedly lured a lion named Cecil out of a national park in Zimbabwe before wounding it with a bow and arrow. Authorities in that country say Palmer and his hunting party followed the feline for about 40 hours before killing it with a gun, removing its tracking collar, skinning, and beheading it. Facebook, Twitter, and the comment section of news sites erupted when the hunter was identified. An online petition demanding justice for Cecil the Lion drew hundreds of thousands of signatures, and late-night host Jimmy Kimmel added his voice to the criticism chorus.
Why are you shooting a lion in the first place? I mean, I'm honestly curious to know why a human being would feel compelled to do that. How is that fun?
Aside from a bit of name-calling, Kimmel's monologue was measured and polite compared with postings on the page for Walter J. Palmer DDS at Yelp.com, a business review website. Many users are calling for him to be prosecuted. Others are posting profanity-laden ad hominem attacks, saying Palmer deserves the same fate as the lion. Yelp spokeswoman Shannon Ice says there have been thousands of these comments posted to Palmer's page.
This week, what we've experienced is the largest we've seen.
Ice compares the backlash against Palmer to the tsunami of hate unleashed against a Florida pizza shop owner in 2012 after he gave President Obama a bear hug, and the Indiana pizza shop owner who told a reporter earlier this year that she'd turn away some gay customers. Ice says Yelp is removing the comments on Palmer's page using both its automatic filtering system and a team of real live humans quick with the delete key, but she says the dentist's Yelp page will stay up.
You come here to figure out what you're going to experience when you do go to a business. That's why we can't remove the page. This is a legitimate business. Our job is to protect the content on that page.
Palmer declined to comment, but in a letter to his patients, the dentist said he hired several professional hunting guides and, quote, to my knowledge, everything about this trip was legal and properly handled and conducted, end quote. Palmer went on to express regret for the taking of the lion and apologized for the disruption of his business. Given the barrage of negative publicity, one might assume Palmer has performed his last root canal, but Jim Lukaszewski, a Twin Cities-based crisis communications consultant, says that's not necessarily the case. Lukaszewski says public relations disasters, even ones this monumental, rarely bring down businesses. And he says Palmer could weather the storm as the media discussion shifts from Palmer specifically to big game hunting in general.
If he remains contrite, if he's cooperative, if he does the things that I think a person in his position should do, he'll become less and less the focus and the issue will become larger.
Lukaszewski says by expressing contrition, Palmer is doing the right thing so far. But Lukaszewski says to regain his reputation, Palmer will have to make amends publicly. That'll likely mean resolving any criminal charges he may face in Zimbabwe. In his statement, Palmer says he'll assist authorities there and in the U.S. in any inquiries they may have. Matt Sepik, Minnesota Public Radio News.
DFL Governor Mark Dayton wants a special legislative session early next month to consider an emergency financial aid package for resorts and other businesses in the Mille Lacs Lake area. State officials are expected to soon shut down walleye fishing on the lake due to dwindling numbers, and Dayton is concerned about the economic ramifications of such a move. Tim Pugmire reports.
No decisions have been made about when to hold a special session or what kind of legislation to include, but Dayton is already kicking around some ideas to help Mille Lacs area businesses. He said a package of state assistance might include zero-interest loans, property tax abatements, and additional tourism promotion in the area. During a news conference, Dayton defended the need for state assistance for private businesses. He also said he wants to provide help as quickly as possible.
The sooner we can get a working capital loan program in place for people, the sooner we can give them the financial assistance they're going to need to pay their staff and basically to continue to keep operating during this time. For now until the end of Labor Day is really, you know, that's their peak season, the summer.
Department of Natural Resources officials impose strict limits on Mille Lacs Lake walleye fishing to try to help the rapidly declining fish population rebound. Dayton said he does not believe the decline is related to American Indian fishing on the lake, but he raised concerns about the tribal practice of gill netting during spawning season, which is allowed under long-standing treaties. Dayton said he also has concerns about the negative attitudes many Mille Lacs area residents have about the DNR and its management of the lake.
I think we need to all pull together now and try some things that have been resisted before and see that we're all in this together, and the tribes as well as the resorters and others there. I mean, everybody's affected by this drastic situation regarding the walleye population, and we, rather than pointing fingers, we need to be pulling together and seeing what we can do to turn the situation around.
Dayton isn't ruling out action on lake management measures, but he stressed that his priority for the special session is immediate aid to businesses. The governor held a private afternoon meeting with members of the Mille Lacs Tourism Board. He plans to visit the area Friday. Following the meeting, resort owner Tina Chapman talked about her concerns.
We're worried that what is going on right now isn't working. What the DNR is doing isn't working, and we need to make some changes to fix the health of the lake.
Other industry representatives also weighed in. Joel Carlson, a lobbyist for the Congress of Minnesota Resorts, said he's pleased that state leaders are ready to help.
Mille Lacs is one of the most popular walleye fisheries in the state and in the country. And so certainly when you restrict fishing on that lake, it's going to have economic consequences, and not just for resorts.
An informal group of legislators and administration officials is expected to begin planning for the special session and the possible legislation. Republican House Speaker Kurt Dowd of Crown said his goal is to provide the right kind of help, and he's not sure a quick special session is the best way to go.
I'm hoping that working group can get together in the next couple of days and take a look at what the situation is, what's caused it, and ultimately, hopefully, all of the possible solutions. And let's try to find something that can provide some relief for these resorts in the best way possible. And I think we have to be creative, probably.
Dowd and Dayton both said that a special session could also include state assistance for the Brainerd area, which was hit hard by heavy storms a few weeks ago. Tim Pugmire, Minnesota Public Radio News at the Capitol.
More layoffs were announced on the Iron Range yesterday. Cliffs Natural Resources will temporarily close its United Taconite mine in Eveleth by the end of next August. The move affects 420 employees. It's another blow to Minnesota's reeling iron ore industry, which has now been hit with over 1,000 layoffs this year. Dan Crocker has more.
Eveleth Mayor Bob Vlasalovich has been nervously awaiting an announcement like this for weeks, ever since he saw the huge stockpiles of taconite pellets sitting alongside the Duluth Harbor, waiting to be shipped to steelmakers.
It was kind of a scary thought down by the harbor there. When you see them, they're about a quarter mile long, three, four of them, a lot of boatloads.
That huge inventory of pellets is one reason Cliffs CEO Lorenzo Gonsalves says the company plans to idle United Taconite for about 6 months. The other reason, Gonsalves told analysts today, is that U.S. steelmakers' demand for Cliffs pellets is down because of a flood of cheap imported steel. And when Cliffs customers are selling less steel, that means they don't need as many Minnesota taconite pellets to make more of it.
As the absurdly high rate of imported steel penetration reverts back to normal levels, and our clients' blast furnaces return to normal operating levels, we expect to be able to adjust our production and our sales volume accordingly.
In the meantime, United Taconite millwright Dan Hill is one of 420 employees planning to lose his job by the end of August. He says workers learned of the decision this morning.
Yeah, it was a shock. I think they were more upset that the media knew before they did.
The shutdown of United Taconite is just the latest blow to the Iron Range's fragile iron mining industry. This spring, U.S. Steel idled its Keetac facility and part of Minntac, the state's largest iron ore mine. Smaller producers Mesabi Nugget and Magnetation also shut down plants, with Magnetation filing for bankruptcy protection. But Hill says the industry appeared to turn a corner last week when Iron Range union leaders announced 400 workers would return to work at Minntac.
That was a light at the end of the tunnel. You know, we thought, well, you know, things are starting to look a lot better now. You know, we're out of the storm. Let's move forward. And then the news came today.
There may be a silver lining in the announcement. Cliff says it will use the shutdown to retrofit United Taconite to be able to make a more valuable and versatile type of taconite pellet. CEO Gonsalves says the company is working with the state to acquire the permits needed to make the change.
I can't thank Governor Dayton enough for all the eliminating red tape to make us able to execute very quickly. So we are working very well together.
Dayton said today Gonsalves called him last night to inform him of the layoffs.
He just said we've been producing too many pellets and we don't have the market for them, especially and ironically with Minntac coming back. That increases the oversupply overall.
Dayton said he's traveling to the Iron Range Friday to meet with affected workers, but there's not a lot state leaders can do to help the taconite industry. College of St. Scholastica economist Tony Barrett says cheap and possibly illegal foreign steel imports are hurting Cliffs and other Iron Range mines that feed the U.S. steel industry.
This is the
stress U.S. steel companies are under. It's from imports. And it's not because the U.S. economy is not doing well. It's simply because the rest of the world's not doing well enough to consume all the steel that's being produced.
The reality of those unforgiving global market forces is hitting home in Eveleth, says Mayor Bob Vlasalovich.
A lot of the younger employees are new to the mining industry who have never been through this. And you know, it's a scary thing. It really is. But you just got to kind of ride it out and plan accordingly.
He says the town has suffered layoffs before and survived. The good news this time, he says, is that Cliffs already has a plan to restart operations, he hopes, by early next year. Dan Crocker, Minnesota Public Radio News, Duluth.
Minneapolis-based Target is expected to complete the sale of its pharmacy business by year's end, assuming regulators approve. Drugstore chain CVS would then take over the pharmacies in some 1,700 Target stores. Martin Moylan looks at what the sale means for Target customers.
Target is ditching the pharmacy business because selling prescription drugs didn't draw enough customers or yield enough profit. But it did generate plenty of sales, $4 billion a year. Those sales represent a lot of people. Target won't specify how many, who'll have to decide if they'll continue getting their meds inside a Target store or go elsewhere. Retail consultant Howard Davidowitz says Target has historically been more focused on lower prices than CVS has. Once CVS is running the pharmacies within Target stores, Davidowitz predicts shoppers will pay more because CVS doesn't make the pay less promise that Target does.
The prices can't be the same, and they won't be the same. Price is central to the entire Target rationale. They're a discounter.
Investors have generally cheered the sale of the pharmacy business to CVS. Davidowitz, on the other hand, is a skeptic because low prices are not a pillar of the CVS business model.
I think it's going to be a major problem. I don't think that Target looked at this correctly. Target has positioned themselves where it was clear to the customer that they were a real alternative to Walmart and their prices were very, very close to Walmart.
CVS promises to provide low-cost generic drugs to Target shoppers, but the company hasn't said whether it will offer the same list of drugs at the same prices as Target. But one change is clear. Shoppers will have to pay cash for those medications, unlike now. A CVS spokesman says the two companies share a goal that the ownership change will not have any, quote, material impact on Target customers buying widely prescribed generic drugs. CVS will also offer its own rewards program to replace Target's popular Red Card pharmacy reward program. Under that system, customers could earn discount cards good for 5% off a day shopping with Target. Unlike Davidowitz, consultant Adam Fine doubts Target shoppers will have to shell out more when buying from CVS. Fine advises drug manufacturers on distribution, but says he's never had CVS or Target as a client.
I don't think it's going to have a huge impact on consumers' out-of-pocket expenses. Consumers who have insurance probably won't see very much of a difference.
His advice for people who don't have coverage?
Shop around. For many years, the pharmacy industry has had what I call a soak-the-poor strategy, where the uninsured will pay the absolute highest prices for drugs.
But even for Target customers who have a health plan, experts say the transition to CVS represents a good time to shop around as well, starting with a review of their coverage. There's a lot of variation in how health plans handle medication costs. Stephen Schondelmeyer is a professor of pharmaceutical economics at the University of Minnesota. He says a pharmacy's retail price can provide a better deal than a health plan does.
Sometimes if the actual cost that the pharmacy would have charged is less than your copay, it may be better for you just to pay cash to the pharmacy.
There are online tools that help consumers sort out prescription drug pricing, among them GoodRx. The company says it has no sponsorship or affiliation with the pharmacies included in its price comparisons. Doug Hirsch is a founder.
Even insured Americans have to become avid consumers and have to do their research. And our mission was really just to try and unravel the mystery and help anyone, whether you're insured or not insured, to understand what it is you're going to pay when you go to the pharmacy.
For some customers, Hirsch says the out-of-pocket cost of even a common generic cholesterol-lowering drug can vary by up to $200 for a single prescription. But in shopping for medications by price, medical professionals say it's prudent to stick with one pharmacy that gives you good savings overall. That allows the pharmacist to see all the medications you're taking and watch for harmful drug interactions. Martin Moylan, Minnesota Public Radio News.
Ever wonder what your cat is saying to you with its eyes, its purr, its puffy tail? Brains On, our science podcast for kids and curious adults, wanted to know, too. Host Molly Bloom and 12-year-old co-host Sophia Gordon talked to cat behavior expert Mikkel Delgado to find out.
Cats do communicate through their eyes, so you can look and see, for example, whether or not they're trying to get more information. So if their eyes are open very big, or you notice that their pupils are dilated, that's a sign that they are trying to take in more information about their environment. So a cat who's in a very playful mode where they're thinking about hunting, or maybe you're playing with them with a toy. But a cat who's afraid would also probably have their pupils dilated as well, which is a normal fear response that we also have, which is when we're kind of in fight or flight mode, our pupils dilate. A cat who's blinking would be showing a sign that they're relaxed in that they don't need constant information. So they might be tired, but they might also just be very comfortable and feel safe enough that they can close their eyes regularly.
When cats are purring, what does that mean?
Purring typically signifies a cat who is content and relaxed, although not always. So I always encourage people when they want to know, you know, what does the tail mean or what does the purr mean, is to look at the entire cat and what's going on. So if your cat is purring and they're on your lap and their eyes are closed, that's probably a sign of contentment. There's still a lot we don't understand about purring, you know, really why cats purr. But some of the theories are that it helps a mom cat bond with her babies. So the purring helps elicit caretaking behavior in the mom. But we also know that cats will purr when they're very frightened or even when they're very injured. So it could be a self-comforting behavior as well. Some believe that purring is actually at a similar frequency to that which would heal tissue. That hasn't been studied in as much detail, but there's some thoughts that maybe the cat is trying to take care of themselves by purring.
I was also wondering, why do cats' tails puff up when they see another animal?
Yeah, so that is called piloerection, and a lot of cats, they'll puff up all over. Some cats just puff their tail, and that's an attempt to look bigger. So the piloerection gives the impression that you shouldn't fight with that cat because that cat is big and possibly scary.
And Sophia, do you feel like your cats, like, communicate with you?
Well, whenever we call my cat Sam's name, he always meows back at us and runs towards us.
Oh, so, that's great. So he knows his name, basically.
Yeah. And a follow-up question to that, do cats actually know their names, or do they come to, like, sounds or words?
That's a really good question. I think you could train your cat to come to a particular sound being their name. I think a lot of cats respond to our tone of voice. So if you always use the same tone of voice when you call, you know, George, so he learns that that tone of voice means you're going to give him attention.
Yeah, my husband and I had an experiment once where he thought the cats knew their name, which was Cosmo. And so he would go Cosmo and the cat would come, but then I started going Sofa in the same voice and the cat still came anyway.
Yeah, I've done that with my own cats too, and the same result. So I think it really is tone of voice because we tend to exclusively use it for them.
To learn more about cats, including how they see in the dark, head to brainson.org or listen to the show in your favorite podcast app. And as I mentioned earlier in the podcast, this one, the NPR News Update, is changing. Next week, Wednesday, the final NPR News Update in podcast form. It changes to The Ticker after that, and you can find it on the nprnews.org webpage in the podcasts section. Starting next Thursday, it's called The Ticker. I'm Phil Picardi. Thanks for joining me today. I'll be back with the Friday news tomorrow.